Marina Warner and Rowan Williams are amongst the preeminent voices of our times. Polymaths, thinkers, writers, academics. In France, they would be called philosophes. They have both held positions from which they have healthily questioned some of the creeping orthodoxies of our times. But the power of their voices and their status in the world of words and ideas has been recognized in the award of some of the nation's key positions. Archbishop of Canterbury, Baron Williams of Oystermouth, and Master of Magdalen College, Cambridge, in Rowan's case, and Fellow of All Saints College, Oxford, Professor of Birkbeck College, London, Fellow of both the Royal Society of Literature and the British Academy, and Chair of the recent International Prize Committee for the Man Booker Prize in Marina's. Their conversation on poetry and belief promises much. So, Marina and Rowan. Okay.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a great delight and privilege to be able to be with you to share this conversation. And what we're going to do is we're each of us going to read some poems that matter to us in illustrating questions about poetry and belief and say a few words about them. We hope that after a bit of exchange, we can open up to observations and comments from you. And we hope that we'll be able to give that a good 20 minutes at the end and finish by 7. Now, when I was studying English at secondary school, one of the poets that we studied for what was then O-level was Edward Thomas. And one of the poems I recall of his begins with the words, "I have come to the borders of sleep." And it's that phrase, "I've come to the borders," that's in my mind, not just because we're in Ledbury. But one of the things that poetry, any kind of poetry does, is take you to the borders, to a frontier, and to hint at and evoke another world, not in the sense of a world that is distant and somewhere else, but the world that is, I think it's a phrase of Rilke, there is another world, but it is the same as this one. Mm-hmm. Looking slant, looking round, looking what you can't see. And so I want to begin with a bit of a poem that to me is very much about borders, about frontiers, and the frontier between past and future, between living and dead, between earth and heaven. And it's a poem, or part of a long poem actually, by Vernon Watkins, who's sometimes been described by myself among others as Swansea's other poet, that is, the one who isn't Dylan Thomas. Watkins wrote a poem called The Ballad of the Murray Lloyd. The Murray Lloyd is a name for a ceremony, an ancient New Year's Eve Welsh ceremony, where the skull of a horse is carried from house to house. And at every house, the singers and dancers carrying the horse's skull knock on the door, and there are verses exchanged, and the skull is ceremonially brought in and paraded around. Watkins takes this ceremony, the turning point of the new and the old year, as the basis for a really unforgettable poetic evocation of the borderland between life and death. So I'll read you just a bit of this. "Midnight, midnight, 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 hark at the hands of the clock. Now dead men rise in the frost of the stars and fists on the coffins knock. They dropped in their graves without one sound, then they were steady and stiff. But now they tear through the frost of the ground, heretic, drunkard, thief. Why should you fear, though they might pass, ripping the stitch of grief, the white sheet under the frosted glass, crisp and still as a leaf? Or look through sockets that once were eyes at the table and white cloth spread, the terrible picklock charities raised the erected dead. Under your walls they gnaw like mice, virtue is unmasked. The hands of the clock betray your vice, they give what none has asked. For they have burrowed beneath the graves and found what the good gave most. Refuse cast by the righteous waves in fossil, wraith, and ghost. Chalice and wafer, wine and bread, and the picklock, picklock, picklock tread. Midnight, 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 midnight. Hark at the hands of the clock. Dead and quiet, evil and good. Frost in the night has mixed their blood. Thieving and giving, good and evil. The beggar's a saint and the saint a devil. Mari Lloyd, Lloyd Mari, a sacred thing through the night they carry. Betrayed are the living, betrayed the dead. All are confused by a horse's head. Midnight, 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 midnight. Hark at the hands of the clock. Lazarus comes in a shroud so white out of the hands of the clock. While baskets are gathered of loaves of light, rape is picking the lock. Hungering fingers, bones of the night. Knock, knock, knock. Mm. It still sends shivers down my spine, which I think good poems ought to do. But if you're talking about frontiers, crossing frontiers, and that strange territory where you're being invited into whatever it is that the Mari Lloyd represents there, the confusing world of the horse's head, where the living and the dead and the past and the future and the night and the day and the old and the young year, they're all mixed up, then that suggests that the poetic exercise is always going to be about what somebody called the connections that you haven't made. And to me, the language of faith has a great deal to do with acknowledging or evoking the connections that you haven't decided to make. So that in religious belief, as in the poetic work, you're being taken into exploring connections where you're feeling your way, and the links are startling and sometimes troubling. One of the great expressions of this in 20th century poetry is the work of David Jones. And although I'd have loved to read vast quantities of David Jones's In Parenthesis, his wonderful long poem about the First World War, I've decided to read some shorter bits from a work called The Anathemata. Anathemata, literally in Greek, things lifted up, things made holy. And this very, very dense and extremely difficult poetic text is one where Jones is trying to show the interconnectedness of pre-Christian, Christian, incipient post-Christian worlds, the connections of Welsh and Roman and English history, Cockney London and Arthurian Britain, all woven together in, well, Marina, you're nodding. I think you know just how powerful that mixture is. The epigraph to the Anathemata is this. It was a dark and stormy night. We sat by the calcined wall. It was said to the tale-teller, tell us a tale, and the tale ran thus. It was a dark and stormy night. That circling character of the imagination is what he celebrates. All of it is, in a sense, a poem about the Mass, about the Christian Eucharist. Because for Jones, as a Catholic, everything is drawn into that moment. And so he imagines the priest at the altar as a poet and as a workman, somebody who is welding together bits of experience, who is making something different, making something other. And for Jones, that's the key to understanding humanity itself. What it is to be human is to be making things different. Not to start from nowhere, but to make the things there are that are there different. Once again, the world's the same, but it's other. And so he begins evoking the figure of the priest. We already, and first of all, discern him making this thing other. His groping syntax, if we attend, already shapes. Ad scriptam, ratam, rationabilem. And by pre-application, and for them, under modes and patterns altogether theirs, the holy and venerable hands lift up an efficacious sign. These at the sagging end and chapter's close, standing humbly before the tables spread, in the apsidal houses who intend life. Between the sterile ornaments, under the pasteboard baldachins, as in the young time in the sap years, between the living floriations under the leaping arches. These rearguard details in their quaint attire, heedless of incongruity, unconscious that the flanks are turned and all connecting files withdrawn or liquidated, that dead symbols litter to the base of the cult stone, that the stem by the palled stone is thirsty, that the stream is very low. This man, so late in time, curiously surviving, shows courtesy to the objects when he moves among, handles, or puts aside the name-bearing instruments, when he shows, every day in his hand, the salted cake given for this gens to savour all the gentes, this people to give flavour to all the nations. Within the railed tumulus, he sings high and he sings low, in a low voice as one who speaks where a few are, gathered in high room and one gone out. Priest and poet co-located at the beginning of that poem. And in that extraordinary image there, it's as if the priest is the last survivor of the legions that have left Britain, the Roman legions that have drained away from Roman Britain. And here's the priest representing that tradition, which is isolated, which is not understood, and which is still there. Dead symbols litter to the base of the cult stone. But the mass goes on. And that means that this is a deeply theological poem, but also one which, like all of Jones's work, prompts some very searching questions about the nature of continuity and the inextinguishable character of our continuities as human beings, the connections we haven't made. And so just one more thing from him. The priest is still at work and he's now remembering the departed, memento etiam, and praying for the congregants, nobis quoque peccatoribus. Upon all four times, from before time, his perpetual light shines upon them. Upon all at once, upon each one whom he invites, bids us to recall, when we make the recalling of him daily at the stone. When the offerant, our service, so theirs, whose life is changed, not taken away, is directed to say, memento etiam. After which it has allowed him then to say, nobis quoque, that we too may be permitted some part with these, like John is, as is Felicity, through the same Lord that gave the naiad her habitat, which is his proto-sign. How else from the weathered mantle rock and the dark humus spread, where is exacted the night labour, where the essential and labouring worm saps micro-workings all the dark day long for his creature of air, how else should his barleys grow, who said, I am your bread?
Well, when I was asked to join you, of course, it's a great honour, and I do feel a bit of an interloper because I'm not a poet, which you are, and I hope you're going to be persuaded to read one of yours. Anyway, so two things came to mind very strongly with the idea of poetry and belief. And the first is that through fairy tales and my interest in myths, I'm very committed to the idea that language has a spellbinding power, and I mean that literally. And I'm aware that in the present world, we have laws against hate speech, which kind of acknowledges that. I mean, the concept of hate speech, which I totally agree with, being banned, acknowledges that words, you know, it's the wrong way around. Sticks and stones can break my bones and words can never hurt me. It's the other way around. Words can definitely hurt you. And it's understood by that law. But what I've been wanting to look at is something that does occur in fairy tales, and that is language that wishes people well, not wishes them ill. And the concept of blessing, it takes many forms in poetry. I mean, it can be a form of praise, and I'm going to open with a praise poem by Hopkins. But it can also be entreaty, elegy. There are many, many old rhetorical forms that exist in poetry, lamentation, which also wishes the person well when you lament for them. So and it's a little bit, to my mind, I'm afraid, it's a bit of a shame that some of this is considered a religious territory, whereas we understand that hate speech is pervasive through the world, but we don't seem to grasp that fair speech could also be pervasive through the world. It doesn't have to be institutionalized. So in the way that, you know, limited to that. And poetry, of course, is the place that you find that. You find this language of fair speech, the language of wishing well, the language of blessing. But the other aspect of poetry and belief that that also comes through the Arthurian legends or the poetry of illusion, and that is that we create in our mind's eye things that we cannot see with our bodies. And we do it through language. We do it through language, mostly through language. Of course, it can also be done visually by artists. But we do it principally through language. We can read a poem to each other of something neither of us have ever seen, and we can see it together. And that, to me, seems to be, you know, that commands belief, and it seems to me to be one of the most extraordinary capacities of human expression. So I will actually read you also some, as it were, fantastic scenes that read completely realistically, beginning with Dante. But this is the praise poem. This is Gerald Manley Hopkins' Pied Beauty, which you will know. I tried to read a bit of on the wonder of Heraclitian fire and the comfort of the resurrection. On the bonfire of Heraclitian fire. I'm getting it wrong. But it's so difficult that I couldn't do it because I'm not an actor. But I can do this one, I think. Pied beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple colour as a brinded cow, for rose moles in all stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow and plough, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how? With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. So I could have read, there's so many in Hopkins, because there's also the wonderful wind hover about the bird, and many, many other magnificent poems of praise in which the language is really moving to open the reader's eyes, to open our eyes, but also to sheer beauty and presence and energy and light. Well, after Dante has gone through hell and has also then climbed the mountain of purgatory, he arrives at the end of the canto, second canto of Purgatorio. He arrives at the earthly paradise. And in the earthly paradise, there are two rivers. And I'm going to read you about the rivers. Dante was quite unusual in choosing only two rivers, because normally paradise has four rivers. But his two rivers, the one is called Lethe, which is a river that comes from the classical tradition and is, as you know, the river of forgetfulness. If you bathe in it, you forget everything that's been unpleasant in Dante. In Dante, that's what happens. When you swim through Lethe, you forget your sins and your ills and your wrongs. And then he invented the other river, which is called Eunoe, which means good knowledge. And I'm going to read you the scene which is the very closing passage of Paradiso, when he drinks the water of good knowledge. So the first bit is the description of, which is from Canto 28, when he's told the river is coming, that he will see the river. And he's told it by the beautiful singing woman, Matilda, who is standing in a flowery meadow singing in the earthly paradise. And she says to him, "And you should know that the holy ground..." Oh, sorry, what I should say is that this is the translation by W.S. Merwin, who is a great American poet in his own right, as well as a very fine translator of Dante. There are many, many translations of Dante, but not so many of Purgatorio. A lot of people have done the Inferno, and some of them quite recently. But so it's quite unusual to get the whole thing done by a fine American poet. So Matilda says, "And you should know that the holy ground where you are is full of seed of every kind and bears fruit that is never picked back there," that's back in hell. "The water that you see springs from no vein, refilled by vapor which the cold condenses, like a river whose power comes and goes, but flows out of a constant and sure fountain that regains as much by the will of God as it pours from openings on either side. On that side it descends with the power to take away the memory of sin and restores that of every good done on the other. Here it is called Lethe, and in the same way on that side, Eunoe, and it works only when it has been tasted on this side and that. And it tastes sweeter than any other, and although your thirst may be completely satisfied if I revealed no more, I will add a corollary as a favor, and I do not think my words will be less dear to you because they go beyond my promise. Those who sang in ancient times of the age of gold and of its happy state saw this place, perhaps, in their dreams on Parnassus. Here the root of humankind was innocent. Here spring and every fruit lasted forever. When they told of nectar, this is what each meant." At that I turned around to my poets, and I saw that they had been listening to this last interpretation and were smiling. Then I turned my face to the beautiful lady again. And then a few cantos on, about five cantos on, at the very, very end, he's now still in the earthly paradise, still with Matilda. He's been joined by seven beautiful women and the poet Statius. I'm just telling you this because they're mentioned. And he's with the two rivers. So here he is. "The seven ladies stopped at the margin of light shadow, such as that which the mountains cast on cold streams under green leaves and dark boughs. I saw before them, it seemed to me, the Euphrates and Tigris rising from one fountain, and like friends parting slowly. O light, O glory of humankind, what is this water that from one beginning flows and takes away out of itself? When I asked her this, she said to me, 'Inquire that of Matilda.' And that beautiful lady answered, as someone who wished to be freed of blame, 'I have told him that and other things, and I am sure that the water of Lethe did not hide it from him.' And Beatrice, 'It may be that some greater concern, which can make one not remember sometimes, has darkened the eyes of his mind. But see Eunoe flowing over there. Lead him to it and revive, as you are used to doing, this weakened power of his. As a gentle soul with no excuses makes of another's will her own, once an outward sign has made it known. So when she had laid her hand on me, the beautiful lady moved on and gracefully, in the way of ladies, said to Statius, 'Come with him.' Reader, if I had more space to write, I would sing something at least about that sweet drink which I could have drunk forever. But since all the pages that were laid upon the loom for this second cantica have been filled, the curb of art lets me go no farther. From the most sacred waters I returned, remade in the way that trees are new, made new again when their leaves are new, pure and ready to ascend to the stars." So in Dante, the idea of having been purged in purgatory, of actually going to heaven, is in fact having this good knowledge, having shed all the evils and ills, than having this good knowledge of this drink of Eunoe. And I don't know why we don't know this phrase, Eunoe, the good river, more. Has something to restore us. So I'll just read one more, I think. So I wanted to bring in, I've become very concerned with the Middle East, as I'm sure most of us are. And I wanted to remember that there was a time, and it isn't really just a golden time like the Eden that is recalled in Dante. It was a very, very, very long period, which seems to be terribly cracking at the moment, when Jews, Christians, Muslims, Zoroastrians, atheists lived in the Middle East not in some sort of cheesy harmony that just didn't want, but in a kind of colloquy, they would talk to each other, they shared ideas, they learned things from one another. They might have erupted in, there were obviously periods of violence, but nothing like what we're having now, I don't think. So I'm going to read you one poem from that era, from the 12th century, in Hebrew. I'm not reading it in Hebrew. It was written in Hebrew by Abraham ibn Ezra. And I think it's a poem about language, but it's a kind of riddle poem. So in a sense, I will try and read it clearly to you so you can decide what you think it's about. But it's definitely a praise poem. I have a garment which is like a sieve through which girls sift barley and wheat. In the dead of night, I spread it out like a tent, and 1,000 stars pierce it with their gleams. Sitting inside, I see the moon and the Pleiades, and on a good night, the great Orion himself. I get awfully tired of counting all the holes, which seem to me like the teeth of many saws. A piece of thread to sew up all the other threads would be, to say the least, superfluous. If a fly landed on it with all his weight, the little idiot would hang by his foot, cursing. Dear God, do what you can to mend it. Make me a mantle of praise from these poor rags. So that was translated 3 years ago by Robert Mezzi. I think it's a very fine, I don't know what the original says, but I think it's a very fine poem in English, so I hope you liked it. All right, thank you.
Dante's Purgatorio is about healing and homecoming, in a way. And the other thing that poetry can do in the realm of faith is to bring to light something of that sense of a homecoming, a desire brought home. W.H. Auden, who was a complex enough man, and complex enough in his beliefs, returned to Christian faith in middle life and wrote a sequence of poems called Horae Canonice, the canonical hours, that is, the offices of the monastic day, Lords and Terce and Sexton, None and Vespers and Compline. And for each hour of the day, each three-hourly prayer moment, he wrote a poem. And this, written probably in 1954, is part of the poem about Compline, the end-of-the-day service. And what's striking about it for me is that it's about healing of a sort going on, once again, round the corner of what we can actually see. We don't quite know how it's happened, but something has. Something's changed. And I find this a very moving and teasing poem. It also reflects his, by this time, unhappy, even tormented relationship with Chester Cullman, his long-term partner, long-term and serially unfaithful partner, who appears just by his initial C in the poem. So Compline. Now as desire and the things desired cease to require attention, as, seizing its chance, the body escapes, section by section, to join plants in their chaster peace, which is more to its real taste. Nowadays it's past, its last deed and feeling in, should come the instant of recollection when the whole thing makes sense. It comes, but all I recall are doors banging, two housewives scolding, an old man gobbling, a child's wild look of envy, actions, words that could fit any tale, and I fail to see either plot or meaning. I cannot remember a thing between noon and three. Nothing is with me now but a sound, a heart's rhythm, a sense of stars, leisurely walking around, and both talk a language of motion I can measure but not read. Maybe my heart is confessing her part in what happened to us from noon till three. That constellation, indeed, sing of some hilarity beyond all liking and happening. But knowing I neither know what they know nor what I ought to know, scorning all vain fornications of fancy, now let me, blessing them both for the sweetness of their cassations, accept our separations. A stride from now will take me into dream, leave me without a status among its unwashed tribes of wishes, who have no dances and no jokes, but a magic cult to propitiate what happens from noon till three. Odd rites which they hide from me, should I chance say, on youths in an oak wood insulting a white deer, bribes nor threats will get them to blab, and then past untruth is one step to nothing. For the end, for me as for cities, is total absence. What comes to be must go back into non-being, for the sake of the equity, the rhythm past measure or comprehending. Can poets, can men in television, be saved? It is not easy to believe in unknowable justice, or pray in the name of a love whose name one's forgotten, libera me, libera si, dear si, and all poor sons of bitches who never do anything properly. Spare us in the youngest day, when all are shaken awake. Facts are facts. And I shall know exactly what happened today, between noon and three. That we too may come to the picnic, with nothing to hide. Join the dance, as it moves, turns about the abiding tree. Now, poetry has been spoken of sometimes as a means of atonement. Geoffrey Hill has a wonderful lecture on this subject, his inaugural lecture at Leeds, I think, many years ago. Atoning words, words that make one, that bring reconciliation. And they do it by quarrying those connections we don't make and don't understand. They do it by sinking into that semi-conscious level, the edges of sleep. Remember, I've come to the borders of sleep, that's what that poem's about. Poetry has to go down to that level and work there, which means, of course, that sometimes poetry can sound very strange and not make very much sense, and sometimes it keeps going round the same circuit again and again. And I couldn't resist a little poem by a rather wonderful contemporary Russian poet, Larissa Miller, where she talks about the repetitiveness of poetry and says, well, actually, maybe it's not such a problem because God does it too. So again and again, I go on about my own stuff. But you see, you too, God, you repeat yourself. Your subjects are not original. Your pictures are hopelessly like one another. Sky, drizzle, rustle of grass. You have your stuff. I have my stuff. How could it be otherwise? The rain falls, and together we merge in the weeping. We've coincided. How could we not have coincided? I, after all, am in your image. My failures are just an unnoticeable part of yours. And another sort of theological poem about poetry and about connections. It was on the very last day of creation that language ascended into rhyme, when And the Lord looked at the work of his hands, and suddenly something sang in him as though a string was touched in the soul, and began to sing all at once. It quivered and caught fire, and all the words that had been living apart prayed through their tears, "Lord, make it so that all can come together and fuse and interweave." And from that day onwards, rhyme quivers like a flame, born from two words at the height of the divine game.
Wonderful. Don't you want to read one of yours?
I'm being invited to read one of mine. high risk. I have a notebook here in which I have a draft of a new one. This has a bit of a history. This year is the centenary of the birth of Thomas Merton, a great American Catholic writer, spiritual writer, poet, essayist, whatever. I went to the centenary conference in Louisville, Kentucky a few weeks ago, and had the privilege of spending the night in Merton's monastery, the Trappist Monastery of Gethsemane, near Louisville, and spending the following morning in what had been Merton's hermitage, a little cinder block bungalow in the woods near the monastery. And it's pretty much as he left it, really. His rocking chair, some of his books, the smell of the wood smoke, the little chapel where he prayed. And I came away, and it sometimes happens that a poem just writes itself for you, and this one just did. So this is for Merton's Hermitage. Today the smell of thunder is wood smoke and dusty paper. The trees burning slowly for 50 years since the strike of lightning that felled and split the knotty growth of silence dropping in a deserted wood. And the smell lingers in cloth, stone, books, the shabby stool parked in front of the table and the icons, in the cheap grain of cinder blocks. The tortoise by the path looks dead. Too much traffic of insects, struck not by lightning, but by the strain of walking in search of water. Coming back, the first drops falling, all the ants have gone, and the tortoise too. The thunders smell like vinegar, perhaps, pinching dead muscles in a sneeze, the burnt dust scattering as a foot falls again. So we walk on, soaked, the smell changing, the wooden music in retreat.
Well, I have a dream poem. I'll read a little bit of it, because well, you mentioned the importance of the world, as it were, beyond our lucid consciousness being so important to poetry, and this is somebody I couldn't find out anything about, but she's called Jean Adams, and she wrote this poem in Glasgow in 1734, and it's called A Dream or the Type of the Rising Sun, and it uses personification, which is something that I like very much in rhetoric. I like the idea that things come to life and speak to you, which, of course, they also do in fairy tales. In fairy tales, in the fairy tale forest, everything in the hermitage would speak to you. And that's something that's enchanted. So Jean Adams invokes the sun, and she imagines nature coming to greet the sun. They all obeyed when, lo, I heard a cry, "Come out and meet the ruler of the sky." Implicit nature altogether ran, their numerous voices seemed a single man, how from my heart the flame leaped to my eye, while through the clear perspective I descry pure nature's unconsulted harmony. "I am his bed," cried out the torrid clime. "He fixed my periods," cried revolving time. "He is my husband," cried the quickening shower. "He's my physician," said the drooping flower. I heard the little insect world all cry. He gave me life and force and wings to fly. The vine cried out, "He nursed me when a plant, even to this hour, he gives me what I want. His virtue brought the moisture to my crop. He formed the blossoms on my trembling top. He made my clusters ready for the press. And shall I not express my thankfulness? He cut my channels," cried the exulting flood. "I owe him all my beauties," cried the wood. "He gave me light and heat," said smiling flame. "I am his shadow," cried exalted fame. "I am his darling," cried unfeigned truth. "And so am I," replied the winged youth. "In all his actions thou mayst see me move. Nay, I have all his soul," cried divine love. Dumb echo cried, "He taught me to repeat. None else could e'er teach me to imitate." "I am his cup," cried pure, unmixed grief. Said heavenly joy, "I fly to his relief." "I am his sword," cried uncorrupted hate. "I quake before him," cried relentless fate. This harmony was noble and divine, all joyed to see their benefactor shine. What I like about that, I mean, is that I wanted to have a woman's voice. But also it seems to me that this sort of simplicity of the rhyme scheme and everything has a quality of the sampler. It has a domestic feel. And I like the idea that, you know, of these cross-stitched maxims that brought joy to houses. They have completely vanished, of course, now. But there was this this longing to sort of create the safe space with these handmade blessings on the wall. Good, all right. And then I'll just close, I think, with a Wallace Stevens. Wallace Stevens is one of my favorite poets. And I actually thought that it sounded as if Auden had been reading him.
I shouldn't wonder.
In those ones. I mean, I'm not familiar with those Ore Canonico poems, and he sounded very different from the Auden I kind of know. And the wrestling with what is reality, when there is all this power of language to create illusions and to forge worlds and to take us beyond into these other worlds. And Wallace Stevens is the great metaphysical poet of that condition, which is a puzzling and troubling condition, because of course it's unstable. We don't know what we're making. Well, these illusions could be dangerous. And in fact, the great poem, An Ordinary Evening in New Haven, ends, "It is not in the premise that reality is a solid. It may be a shade that traverses a dust, a force that traverses a shade." But I want to read you the poem called Angel Surrounded by Paysans. Paysans being French for peasants, and for some reason that's the title. It's very, very cryptic. And this is about the sort of hinted presence, which is what I think I sensed from your Merton poem. The presence that is there but not there at the same time. One of the countrymen. "There is a welcome at the door to which no one comes." The angel. "I am the angel of reality, seen for a moment standing in the door. I have neither ashen wing nor wear of awe, and live without a tepid aureole, or stars that follow me not to attend, but of my being and its knowing part. I am one of you, and being one of you is being and knowing what I am and know. Yet I am the necessary angel of earth, since in my sight you see the world again. Sorry. Since in my sight you see the earth again, cleared of its stiff and stubborn man-locked set. And in my hearing you hear its tragic drone rise liquidly in liquid lingerings, like watery words awash, like meanings said by repetitions of half-meanings. Am I not myself only half of a figure of a sort, a figure half seen or seen for a moment, a man of the mind, an apparition, apparelled in apparels of such lightest look that a turn of my shoulder and quickly, too quickly, I am gone." Thank you.
We've both been enjoying ourselves so much, I'm afraid, that we've run over the time we'd allotted. But I wonder if I could just round off the bit from the stage with two things. One is that, as you probably know, part of what's happening at this festival is, in the name of the English Pen Group, there's a poetry's protest campaign highlighting the situation of writers who are at risk or in prison around the world. And Omar Hasek is a poet currently serving a 2-year prison sentence in Egypt, back to the Middle East and all its tragedies. Mm. And one thing that's happening at the festival is we're reading some of the poetry of these people at risk or in jail. So a little bit of Omar Hasek. I run with the sea. It's a poem dedicated to Konstantin Kavafi, the great Alexandrian Greek poet. Mm. I run with the sea, I outstrip it, it outstrips me. The full moon laughs, words take flight from my mouth to play in the sand, mix up the letters and scatter their names. However, the stride of the sea is bigger. My heart is small and trembles like the eyes of birds. The sea wave toys with my words. Its stride lengthens through my letters, teaching them how to catch a squirrel in the branches of rhymes, how to splash water over a child. It outstrips me. The full moon's laughter grows. O sea, my heart is small, but it holds a procession of lovers and a song that anew found not its harbour. In my songs the sea is azure, and the fish of my heart now leap to it, and I follow, laughing, laughing. This is Alexandria that bears the voice of Kavafi, a child on its shoulders that runs along the sea, scattering its turquoise. Alexandria, her poet has come. Alexandria, her poet has come. And last, because no session on faith and poetry can really be complete without George Herbert, indulge me with the greatest poem in the English language. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful, ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and, smiling, did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. But know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. We have some time, just a little time, for comments and questions, so please.
There's a microphone. There's a microphone. There's a microphone in the middle,
yes.
Thank you for two lovely talks. Do the poems of Emily Dickinson feature at all in your views on poetry and belief? And if so, in what way?
You start.
Well, I did nearly choose Emily Dickinson, absolutely. In a way, I do regret that I didn't. I suppose I felt that... I know that Hopkins and Dante are pretty obvious, but I thought she was perhaps very obvious. But I regret it. I would like to have... I would like to have chosen her. Mm-hmm.
One of the fascinating things about poets like Emily Dickinson, if there are any poets like Emily Dickinson, is that absolute fascination with the stuff of faith and absolute refusal to come out with the easy phrases, the quick words, and the stumbling, the hesitation, the... was a theology of punctuation in Emily Dickinson. Mm. Holding us back. Saying, don't say it yet. Pause. I think there's something deeply faith imbued about that, but it's not a conventional religiousness, and at the same time very deep.
Actually, I remembered one of my inhibitions, and that is that I actually read a poem quite recently at a funeral. That's why I didn't do it. Yeah. I read the Many Chambered, and I spread my hands, the spreading of my something hands to gather paradise. Narrow hands, the spreading of my narrow hands to gather paradise, it ends. I dwell in possibility, a greater house than prose, more something of windows, more something of doors. Sorry.
In the poem that starts, "This world is not the Buddha, the species stands beyond," ends up with the still the tooth
that niggles. Yes, absolutely, yes. Yes.
Drink to that, I think. Yes.
Yes. There's also the idea of the self is a haunted house.
Mm.
The idea of that there is something larger, that one is confined, and she's very good at that. One's confined in a, especially in her case, she led such a confined life. But nevertheless, in this confinement of both the body space and the house space, there are all these other worlds that she can touch and inhabit. That's very strong in her imagination.
You spoke about Thomas Merton. How would you equate him with the Desert Fathers? Were they an earlier version of Thomas? Or Thomas a later version of the Desert Fathers?
A very interesting question. The Desert Fathers didn't go in for writing poetry and letters very much. But what they do have in common, I think, is this. And Merton comes out with it more and more clearly, especially in the late 50s and early 60s. The person who goes to be a monk or a hermit is the person who's trying to see things more clearly. The early monks of the desert and nuns of the desert went away from Roman society to see it from a distance and to see themselves more clearly. Merton, as his involvement in the anti-Vietnam War movement and the civil rights movement developed, believed very strongly that he'd been put there in that monastic situation so that he could see what a lot of American society was refusing to see. And I think that's one of the great points in common.
I want to say something more about Emily Dickinson. Sorry, you made me think about her. And that is the ambiguity of ecstasy. It's also about the Desert Fathers, too. Where you get poetry pushing out beyond the extremes of feeling into these ecstatic states. And very often, the transformations that take place are highly erotic as a result. So that in that moment of the sort of transcendence, it kind of returns very incarnationally to the body. Mm. Wild nights were I with thee, wild nights would be our ecstasy. Yeah. And then rowing in Eden, the sea. You know, that's the most incredible erotic poem. And it's about heaven, really.
And, of course, very much how a great contemplative poet like St. John of the Cross works in the spiritual canticle. My beloved is the mountains, the rustling groves, the flowing rivers. You go through this stripping and emptying, and on the other side, the world suddenly is there.
Mm.
Just there. Yes. As never before, and the eroticism in that, both in relation to the world as a whole, sort of eroticism about the whole created order,
yes,
and a very intense personal openness to God as well. That it's very powerful.
I think you mentioned one of them. You were saying that it was about making. Was it David Jones? Making, because David Jones, of course, was an artist and also a type cutter.
Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful letter cutter and calligrapher, but also cut the letters in stone. And I think that's a theme that's returning very strongly in contemporary attempts to feel some kind of unification with the world. I mean, it can be religious in some cases, people who have faith, but it's actually a trend, I think, that's beyond that, too, that people are very, very obsessed now with, if you can make something physically, it will actually center you, relate you. It's possibly a response to the digital, you know, vaporized, disembodied world of digital technology. But that it, there's been a real return to grounding in making.
And I think that has something to do with this business of connections, again, the connections we haven't chosen. Because, of course, most of the connections we haven't chosen are sheer physical dependence in the world and reconnecting with our simple bodily presence, the fact that we get wet and cold, and for that matter warm and dry too, that we feed, that we breathe, and our physical making becomes part of that. And of course, making words isn't that different, because language is something we do with this stuff. It's a bodily act. Sorry, there's somebody waiting.
Rowan, you read some David Jones, and Elizabeth Jennings and many others have told me that he was the most important religious poet of the last century. I just can't get into, in parentheses, can you give us some tips how you actually get into David Jones?
Well, he does need a lot of footnotes, unfortunately. That's the problem.
You said there was a recording.
There is a recording of Jones reading, and there's also a recording of In Parenthesis with Dylan Thomas and Richard Burton, which is quite something. Mm-hmm. And I think hearing it helps. In Parenthesis is a drama, among other things. And if you try to read it on the page cold, it can be very difficult. I think having voices reading it aloud is one way in. The Anathemata is even more difficult, to be honest. And while I would agree that he is a massively important figure, I think he also fails at times to resist the temptation just to overwork the material and jam everything in. So there are wonderful passages of the Anathemata and passages also where I think, oh, I wish we could just pull this out a bit more. But In Parenthesis, a drama, a play for voices almost. You've got to listen to the Sergeant Major, you've got to listen to the Welsh soldier and his soliloquy. You've got to listen to the echoes of archaic poetry coming in, and the Arthurian legend, the Middle English, the modern Cockney again. So I think perhaps listen.
So I'm very glad to hear you talk about sound, because when you said about, you know, that language is made in the mouth, it's very, the idea of the breath and the idea of the music they're both very central to the experience of poetry, and possibly rather a bit neglected, because there's such an emphasis on intelligibility of language now. We tend to wish to learn foreign languages in order to communicate concepts or data. But actually, listening to the music of a language is an experience, and we don't resist it when we listen to a song sung in a foreign language. I mean, if we hear a ballad sung in a language we don't understand, we don't immediately say, what is that? Because, it's speaking through the music in some way or other. And the music is there also in poetry. And the amazing thing about translated poetry is that quite a lot of these translators are so skilled now, they do get music into it. I mean, they get an English music into a poem that's come from quite a remote language, like Hebrew or Arabic or something. They still manage to get get that pulse in it.
That's the challenge, I think. Mm. Not just to translate a set of ideas, but to translate a sequence of sound, to move a sequence of sounds from one context to another, which will change it, of course, but at least to see it as a physical act, something you hear.
Yes.
We've overrun our time, I think. But there's one... We'll take one more question.
Hello. How do you do this? It seems to me that there's a tendency for poets to talk in the I, in the first person, whether that's autobiographical or whether it's a persona. And given the state of the world, and has always been, that doesn't seem to reflect the world as a social animal. I wondered what you thought of that. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting question. We could be here another hour on that, I think. I don't know. I think that a poet who never does anything but speak from an individualized eye, an autobiographical center, is really missing something. But the eye of the poet is always, or almost always, I would say, more than just that individual. And when you use the first person in a poem, I think you're using it with a kind of provisionality, a kind of openness. Because the whole enterprise of poetry takes for granted that your voice is shaped by listening. You're listening for the sounds, the music. You're listening for what I call the connections. And you're trying in the poem itself to open up or even sometimes re-establish connections. So it's a bit paradoxical. There are poems that are, on the face of it, deeply personal, individual. Eliot's A Wasteland, I suppose, which are at the same time a way of drawing out the patterns of an entire society, an entire way of thinking. So I have to think more about that, but that's just a sort of off-the-cuff thought about it. I get very fed up with poets who are just confessional, just saying, this is how I'm feeling, because the appropriate reader response to that is, so? Whereas the poet who is showing you something about language you never noticed before and making you spot the links and hear the echoes is doing something much bigger and opening up your possibilities, whoever you are and wherever you are.